From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a plea for a captured Jordanian pilot. A look back at how the Ebola outbreak began a year ago, remembering the Indian Ocean tsunami, and what's ahead in U.S. politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The father of a Jordanian captured by Islamic State militants in Syria is pleading with the rebel group for the fighter pilot's safe return. Safi al-Kasa Eba appealed to the religious extremists, he said, to treat his son as a guest, not a hostage, telling them, "We are all Muslims." Jordan confirmed on Wednesday that the pilot is being held. The F-16 fighter jet he was flying as part of the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State went down near the rebel stronghold of Raqqa. That's in northern Syria. U.S. military has acknowledged that the plane crashed but denied a claim by the Islamic State that its militants shot it down. Jordan is one of several countries in the region participating in the air campaign against the militants. The search for a negotiated settlement to the Syrian civil war is gaining some steam. Russia, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's chief international ally, is trying to convene peace talks in Moscow between Syrian government representatives and the mainstream opposition on how to move toward a political transition. It's not yet clear who will take part in the talks. The main Western-backed Syrian opposition does not trust Russia and maintains that any negotiated settlement must be based on the Geneva communication platform, which states that there should be a political transition in Syria toward democracy by the formation of a transitional governing body with full executive powers. Two rounds of peace talks between government and opposition representatives in Switzerland in early 2014 ended in failure. Analysts say the Moscow Peace Conference, which some refer to as Moscow One, could be a first step toward ending the war if all parties agree to participate. VOA senior Middle East correspondent Mohammed El-Shenawy asked Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University, if Moscow One has a better chance of success since the talks with all those parties involved, unlike the Geneva One and Two talks.
You know, I think that this attempt is going to have as little impact as the Geneva process. I think that the plan that Moscow has, you know, makes some sort of superficial changes, but basically leaves Assad in charge. And I don't think even the moderate opposition is interested, much less the immoderate opposition. And so I think it'll be very difficult for Russia to hammer out an agreement. And even if it does, those opposition groups that take part in it, I think, will be vilified by all the others.
But what's motivating Russia to mediate a conflict that both the United States and the UN failed to handle so far?
I think that Moscow may hope that it can actually succeed, but certainly even if it tries, I think that certainly just the, you know, the self-image of Russia is that it's, you know, a responsible party, that it's, you know, there's all kinds of tensions in Europe with the West, but here Russia is acting moderately, and that this should give the West an incentive to be understanding of Russia's position, because after all, Russia also wants to avoid ISIS from taking power in Syria.
Would the threat of the so-called Islamic State change the dynamics of negotiating a political settlement to the Syrian civil war?
You know, it might. But I think the problem, though, is that any opposition movement that is willing to make a deal with the Assad regime, seeing the Islamic State as a common opponent, I think this will just play into the hands of the Islamic State, that they will be able to castigate them as traitors. And I think it'll be very difficult for such a group to retain credibility.
Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Mikhail Bogdanov announced after visiting Syria that Russia is ready to host a U.S.-Syrian dialogue after President Assad said he is ready to be a partner in the war against the Islamic State. How would that happen when the United States insisted that Assad has to step down?
I think it'll be very difficult. I'm not even sure that the United States is all that concerned whether Assad actually stepped down, but it certainly isn't going to support him openly to stay in power, that this would make relations with Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates in particular, very difficult. So I think that the U.S. is really sort of caught in a dilemma. You know, whatever hopes it may have had that a moderate opposition could come to power are long gone, that it seems that we either have Assad or we have the Islamic State, and neither is a good option.
Mark Katz is a professor of government and politics at George Mason University. He was speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. Also in the news, the African Union mission in Somalia says 9 people are dead after Al-Shabaab militants attacked its base on the edge of Mogadishu International Airport. AU mission known as Amazon says 5 attackers, 3 AU soldiers, and 1 civilian contractor died in the ensuing struggle for control of that base, and 3 Al-Shabaab militants were captured. Amazon says it did regain control of the base and restored normalcy. In claiming responsibility for the attack, Al-Shabaab said the raid targeted a Christian party at the base. You heard the word unprecedented a lot this year to describe the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. It has killed more than 7,500 people and infected nearly 3 times as many. All of this after the virus spent decades in isolated forest on the other side of the continent, popping up intermittently and killing a few hundred people at a time at the most. But in West Africa, Ebola crossed borders and reached cities, sparking global alarm. The epidemic is still not under control. VOA's And Look remembers the year of the Ebola outbreak.
Getting your temperature taken has become the norm at airports and border crossings around West Africa this year. Fever is one of the first symptoms of Ebola. In the 3 hardest hit countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, people try not to shake hands or hug. You are not supposed to care for your sick or bury your dead as before. The bodily fluids of Ebola patients and victims spread the disease. The regional epidemic is not under control, not even in southeastern Guinea, where it began in December 2013. Months passed before the virus was identified. Ebola spread to the capital, Conakry, and then crossed into Sierra Leone and Liberia. Cases began to surge in those 2 countries in June. Ebola was new to West Africa. There was confusion, miscommunication, and fear. Some people resisted treatment and safe burials. People in a Monrovia suburb rioted. Governments responded with what they called shock therapies, like area lockdowns and quarantines. They increased education efforts. Billboards went up. Ebola is real, they said. Health workers walk the streets teaching people about the symptoms. They continue to go door to door looking for possible cases.
You don't know as to whether you have any sick person, somebody suffering from malaria, fever, typhoid, pressure.
To stop the spread of Ebola, the sick must be isolated and treated by trained staff wearing head-to-toe protective gear. Those who die from Ebola must be buried by special crews. But response efforts couldn't keep up. Ebola had laid bare these countries' already inadequate health systems, and then it crippled them even further. Sierra Leone's health minister, Dr. Abubakar Fofana.
I can probably count with my fingers the number of ambulances that we had when the outbreak was declared. And for a population of 6 million people in a terrain as difficult as the one that we had.
By September in Monrovia, the number of cases was doubling every 3 weeks. Regular hospitals were closed. There weren't enough beds or staff at Ebola treatment units. Jackson Nyama, a Liberian medic working for Doctors Without Borders, addressed the UN Security Council by teleconference.
We have to turn people away, and they are dying at our front gate. Right now, as I speak, there are patients sitting at our front gate, literally begging for lives. If the international community does not stand up we will be wiped out.
The UN launched a regional Ebola mission. The United States sent 3,000 troops to build Ebola treatment units in Liberia. October was the start of a massive scale-up in international response that continues into 2015. Experts say there are still months of work ahead. About half of those killed by Ebola this year were in Liberia. Most of the rest were in Guinea and Sierra Leone. In all, 8 countries on 3 continents reported cases. It was, as people kept saying, unprecedented. Those killed included some 350 health workers in West Africa. Sierra Leone lost 3 doctors in the first half of December alone. But there were some victories. About 40% of those infected this year who received medical care survived. Senegal and Nigeria acted fast and contained small outbreaks in their countries. And the sheer scale of the regional epidemic jump-started stalled research efforts into Ebola worldwide. Trials for vaccines and possible drug treatments are underway and have raised hope for an effective response to Ebola sometime in the near future. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Today marks the 10th anniversary of one of the world's deadliest natural disasters, the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, triggered by a 9.3 magnitude earthquake off the western Indonesian coast. It killed more than 230,000 people, affecting 14 countries, displaced millions, and caused billions of dollars in damage. There were no warning systems in place at the time and not enough time for people to find higher ground before the giant waves hit coastlines as far away as Africa. It took just 20 minutes after the quake for the first wave, some more than 35 meters high, to hit the coast of Aceh, where the vast majority of people perished. Eric Geist, a research geophysicist with the U.S. Geologic Survey, told VOA's Victor Beatty the scope of the disaster was unprecedented in recorded history and was made more worse because it was so unexpected.
A major magnitude 9 earthquake had not occurred in the Indian Ocean in recent history. And, of course, in recent years, the population density of people living near the coast all over the world, but especially in that part of the world, has increased tremendously. So the conditions were right for such a disaster to happen, but I don't believe any geoscientists foresaw a magnitude 9 occurring in that part of the world.
What was the key thing that caused so much damage and loss of life?
Primarily, the population density living at very low elevations near the coast. That and the lack at that time of a tsunami warning system. So there was virtually no warning to most of the people other than the natural warning of ground shaking or the ocean receding before the strong waves came ashore.
How likely is such an event to recur?
It might not occur for a long time in that same area, but there are other parts of the fault zone and other fault zones in the Indian Ocean that might sustain a earthquake of that size and perhaps even a tsunami of that size.
Has anything changed? Have any lessons been learned to protect against future such catastrophes?
Yes, the tsunami warning systems around the world have changed tremendously in the last 10 years. In particular, in the Indian Ocean, we now have these deep ocean pressure gauges that are very good at detecting tsunamis. India and Thailand both have these deep ocean gauges. In addition, 3 countries, India, Indonesia, and Australia, have developed their own regional warning systems. So the state of tsunami warning in the Indian Ocean has vastly improved in the last 10 years.
Will these warning systems be enough to warn people who still live near the coastline?
The trick is in getting the warning out in time for locations very close to the earthquake. That's when the tsunami may only take 15 minutes to come ashore. So that's a very short amount of time. In general, we have the technology to get a warning out within a few minutes. The hard part is the last mile problem, where the emergency managers have to get that information out to the public that's living very near the coast. And that's often the most difficult situation, as well as getting those people evacuated.
And while Guy says the Asia-Pacific region could experience a similar size earthquake and tsunami in the next 100 years, he says a recurrence in or near the same location is unlikely because of the so-called mean return time for such an event is a very long period, perhaps a millennia or longer. Critics and moviegoers in New York told the Associated Press on Thursday that Sony's controversial comedy, The Interview, is less than a masterpiece. But thanks to threats from hackers that nearly derailed its release, it has become an event. Hundreds of smaller independent cinemas made special holiday arrangements in the U.S. to screen the film, which depicts the assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The hackers threatened violence if Sony didn't pull the movie, but that did not stop moviegoers from going to the Cinema Village Theater in New York from seeing that film on Thursday. Ken Jakowitz and Derek Carpell saw the movie.
It's a funny movie. The audience was laughing, I was laughing, and at the end of the movie, I was even on the edge of my seat some. This is a funny movie. And, you know, okay, it is about the assassination of a foreign leader, but in America, we don't fear laughing at our leaders.
It's a stupid buddy comedy movie. I think the importance of it is, of course, that we come out here and we support people who believe in free speech.
Sony Pictures had initially called off the release after major cinema chains dropped the movie that was to have opened in as many as 300 screens. But with President Obama, among others, criticizing the decision, Sony officials changed their minds. 2014 proved to be a difficult year politically for President Obama and a very good year for the U.S. Republican Party. Republicans gained in the November midterm elections. It gave them control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the next 2 years, setting the stage for more confrontation and gridlock in the final 2 years of the Obama presidency. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview.
Republicans will control both chambers of Congress come January, following their victories in the November midterm elections, presenting President Obama with a major political challenge in his final 2 years in office. But Mr. Obama has already signaled a willingness to act boldly on his own to protect undocumented immigrants from deportation and in launching a new diplomatic opening to Cuba.
After all, these 50 years have shown that isolation has not worked. It's time for a new approach.
With control of both chambers in 2015, House Speaker John Boehner, a Republican, says his party is ready to show the country that it's capable of governing.
Of course, the opportunity to serve the American people is always humbling. It's even more so at a time when our country faces such great challenges. We're ready and eager to get to work.
Republican control of Congress in the final 2 years of the Obama presidency could set the stage for more partisan gridlock, says Republican strategist Philip Stutz.
I also think there's a limited window going into 2015, and then once some of the potential presidential candidates start staking out positions and announcing, then I think all bets are off. It's just going to be war. No one's going to get along, and it's just going to be the kind of thing that everybody hates about Washington all over again.
Republican efforts to bolster their party's image could pay dividends as voters look ahead to the 2016 presidential election, says University of Chicago expert William Howell.
They need to demonstrate their ability to effectively govern, that they can't strictly and solely be an obstructionist force in American politics. They need to demonstrate their ability to get stuff done.
The focus will increasingly shift to presidential politics during 2015, including the expected candidacy of Democrat Hillary Clinton.
So we know we have work to do. We have to knock down barriers. Women themselves have to develop the confidence to to pursue their ambitions.
Clinton may have to win over some liberal Democrats drawn to the economic populism of Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Wall Street is doing very well. CEOs are bringing in millions more, and families all across this country are struggling. We have to make this government work for the American people.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is actively exploring a presidential run, the first of many in what is expected to be a large Republican presidential field.
I have no clue if I would be a good candidate. I hope I would be. I think I could serve well as president, to be honest with you, but I don't know that either.
Bush's step toward a presidential campaign raises the prospect of another Clinton-Bush matchup in the 2016 race, a reminder that both families remain the closest thing to a modern political dynasty in U.S. politics. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
Today is the day after Christmas and is celebrated by the Western Church as the Feast of Stephen, a Christian Saints Day to commemorate Saint Stephen, also known as the first Christian martyr. It's celebrated in the Eastern Church tomorrow. There is a popular Christmas carol called Good King Wenceslas. It tells the story of a king braving the harsh winter weather to give alms to a poor peasant, and he did that on the Feast of Stephen. In 1853, English hymn writer John Mason Neal wrote the Wenceslas lyrics, that in collaboration with his music editor Thomas Helmore. The music was actually written in Finland about 300 years before. Here is guitarist and singer Laurie Lee C. with Good King Wenceslas.
Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen, when the snow lay round about, deep and crisp and even, brightly shone the moon at night, though the frost was cruel, when a poor man came in sight.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday. Now a bit more of Laurie Lee C. singing Good King Wenceslas.
Goodly kings underneath the mountain, right against the forest fence, by St. Agnes Fountain. Bring me flesh and bring me wine, bring me pine logs hither, thou and I will see him dine when we bear him thither. Page and monarch, forth they went together, through the rude wind's wild lament, and the bitter weather. Sire, the night is darker now, and the wind blows strong. Fails my heart, I know not how, I can go no longer. Mark my footsteps, my good page, tread thou in them boldly. Thou shalt find the winter's rage, freeze thy blood less coldly. In his master's steps he trod, where the snow lay dinted. Heat was in the very sod which the saint had printed. Therefore, Christian men.
This is Today in History. On December 26, 2004, an earthquake off the Sumatran coast of Indonesia triggered a series of devastating tsunamis that spread across the Indian Ocean. The waves inundated coastal communities in parts of Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, Thailand, and as far away as Africa. Estimates have put the worldwide death toll at more than 200,000, making the catastrophe one of the deadliest disasters in modern history. On this day in 1991, the Supreme Soviet of the Soviet Union met to formally dissolve the Soviet Union. In 1825, reformist Russian army officers and soldiers protested against the new Tsar Nicholas I. The Decembrist revolt was quickly put down by forces loyal to Nicholas. Several rebels were executed, others were exiled to Siberia. On this day in 1898, the discovery of the highly radioactive chemical element known as radium was announced by Marie Curie and her husband Pierre. Madame Curie was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery. She is the only person to have received two Nobel Prizes. The other was in chemistry. On this day in 1963, Capitol Records released the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand in the United States.
Oh yeah! Something I think you'll understand when I say that something I wanna hold your hand.
The record, which had been released in Britain the month before, reached number one in the U.S. 5 weeks later. 1 year later, on this day in 1964, the Beatles celebrated their sixth number one single in a year when I Feel Fine topped the charts. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the second anniversary of the unexplained disappearance of one of Laos' most respected civil society figures. Sombat Somphone was abducted by unknown assailants on the evening of December 15, 2012, from a Lao police checkpoint in Vientiane, and hasn't been seen since. This deplorable act was recorded on Lao government surveillance cameras. From a poor farming family, Sombat was educated in the U.S., attending high school in Wisconsin, then earning degrees at the University of Hawaii. He founded the Participatory Development Training Center in 1996. His projects range from organic farms to model rural schools to enlisting monks in helping fight drug abuse among youth. In 2005, he won the Magsaysay Award, Asia's equivalent of the Nobel Peace Prize. The United States remains deeply concerned over Sombat's fate and the chilling message it sends other members of civil society who work to improve the lives of their countrymen. Our nation's thoughts are with Sombat's family, friends, and the countless others in the international community who have been inspired by his exemplary leadership and devotion to his country. The United States welcomes recent statements by the Lao president, Prime Minister, and others expressing their concern over Sombat's disappearance. We reiterate our call for the Lao government to conduct a full, thorough, and transparent investigation and to take all measures necessary to solve the case and ensure Sombat's safe return to his family.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.